tonight on Arena, Rita Ann Higgins at the Dublin Book Festival, Broken Talkers, The Mirror Stage, The Project, and Ruan McGann on the Dingle Film Festival. Welcome along to a brand new week on Arena. You can text us 51551 if you'd like to get in contact during the programme. Email arena@rte.ie, and you'll find us on Instagram as well @RTE_arena. The Dublin Book Festival 2025 gets underway next Wednesday, November 5th. There is a wealth of events taking place over the 5 days, including book launches and panel discussions and creative workshops. One such event is She Tells It Straight, a thought-provoking presentation where poets Áine Ní Ghlin and Rita Ann Higgins speak truth in Irish and English through bold and unsentimental poems. Rita Ann is no stranger to unsentimentality, nor is she a stranger to this programme. Welcome, Rita Ann.
Thanks a million, Rick. Good to talk to you.
We're approaching Halloween, the eve of All Hallows. Does this time of year have any special meaning for you?
I like Halloween. I loved it as a child. I like it now because we have a bride witch in the hall, and she's in white, but she's a skeleton. She lights up and she makes horrendous noises, and the kids love it and fear it, love her and fear her. So it used to be automatic when you open the door, she would do this scradil, but she doesn't know. You have to press a button on the back of her neck. So when the little ones come round, they do love it, and you have to keep doing it, and they keep coming back, and it's fun. It's a kid's thing really, isn't it?
What does the postman make of that?
I don't know.
You've got some poems of your own that are well known and that are all connected to this time of the year as well. I thought you might like to recite something first. Maybe I Liked My Father at Halloween. Maybe tell us about that.
I'll just maybe tell you a little bit about it and read it for you. I loved Halloween as a child because we really got involved with the whole fun part of it, you know. And my father was a lot of fun at that time. So it's called I Liked My Father at Halloween. It gets earlier every year. The bangers start going off when October isn't even a shadow in the hall. Nothing much happens when the zombies and witches statue at your door. They hold wide open the plunder bag and you throw the booty in. They rarely raise a rhyme, a skipping song, a half a random rattle-tattle tic-tac-toe song, much less a Halloween is coming. I liked my father at Halloween. He got into the swing of things when we tried to bite the apples that were hanging from the door hinge on a coil around twine. Peals of laughter echoed off the walls. We became the whirling dervish, our hands secured behind our backs, nose-butting the apples every time. When we tried to get the threepenny bit or the tanner out of the basin of water with our teeth, his giant's laughter filled the house again. No need to hedge our bets when it came to the boreen brack. Fever pitch was nothing as we watched out for that ring. Monkey nuts were flush and teeming. You feel for the cats and dogs who are terrified of the bangers going off. You pity yourself for harbouring memories that tightrope the threshold of melancholy. You pity the children who know no rhymes.
Does that mean Halloween as itself, as I suppose it has to, has changed for you over the course of the years from something joyous to maybe something slightly different?
Well, it's changed in that the kids just hold the bags open. And you just have to give. And they don't, the traditions aren't being handed down, really. Isn't that what it's about? You know, so it was all tradition when I was growing up, very long time ago. I love tradition and I love rhymes and I love if a kid said a poem or a song or any old thing, but they don't seem to, not a lot anyway.
Definitely. You know? Songs are not a thing that are happening these days for an awful lot of kids when they show up at the front door.
It's more on through it. It's a pity.
Tell me about All Souls Day, because you've a poem that reflects that as well, and that's obviously quite different.
All Souls Day, you see, it's getting darker now. So it's October, we're coming up to Halloween, and then we have All Saints, and then we have All Souls. All Souls was a little bit dark because the story you knew was that people needed your prayers, and you had to pray like Billy off to get the souls out of purgatory. Sorry about making the noise with the paper. I should know better. All Souls Day. Novembers were dark and the responsibility was great. You had to get the souls out of purgatory, write their names down no matter how distant a relative they were. Be sure and place the list in the altar cavity where God's messenger on earth would find it. He loved a game of hide and seek. Always be afraid, have guilt and shame in equal measure. Don't forget to pray and pray. You have a responsibility to the souls in purgatory. I did my fair share of praying in my day, so I don't have to do it anymore.
You're a keen observer of life and of injustices. I think Paul Durkin once said you were a powerful force for change as well. Oh. What is it that you're observing at the moment that is taking your eye?
You're going to squeeze this out of me anyway, Rick, aren't you?
That's entirely an open question, Rita.
No, and I didn't really mean that about the prayer. I pray all the time because I'm afraid of dogs, and if a dog is chasing me, I always say aspirations. What am I doing at the moment? I'm working on a TV series. I had been working on a full feature film, and then I was lucky enough to be chosen as a Screen Ireland fellow as part of Screen Ireland and the Stowe Labs and the Film Flat. So I had a week in Renville. Just recently there, Renville House Hotel. It was fantastic. The food is amazing. And I had my script. So you work with your peers first and you discuss theirs, they discuss yours. And then you move to the mentors. And the mentors are directors and producers. And I had great fortune to meet people that loved my script. And they said it was very overpopulated, which isn't surprising if you had a look inside my head. So many characters, so many voices. So they said, you know, you've got to make a TV series out of this. So that's what I'm working on at the moment, a TV series.
That must be an extraordinary experience to go into something like that and come out with, because of the nature possibly of the mentorship you were given, with an entirely different direction for something you were working on.
Yeah, no, really, it's not anything like poetry either. So it's very different. It was very exciting because it could have gone either way. They could have said, now, there were lots of things wrong with my script, like the formatting, little tweaks. You'd be telling the director things and they hate that. You know, they hate you telling them what to do or anything. So I learned an awful lot even on that level. But then my forte, if you like, according to them, was the dialogue. So I can work on the dialogue, but I must work on the other stuff as well, the stuff around the dialogue. But I do love dialogue, so that's not a big issue. It's just doing it right. And I'm just doing a kind of a 26-minute sets. You know, it's either 26 minutes or 42. If you're going for the hour, it's 42. But I'm going to try the 26 is what I'm working towards at the moment. It's a dark comedy and Lacuna J.
I'll be honest with you.
It's the one who doesn't pray.
I'm always looking for a good 26-minute dark comedy. There's very few of them, very few that are worth staying with for a series. Is this a strange one insofar as obviously working as a poet is quite a solitary endeavour, but something like this by the very nature of it has to be something that's not just collaborative with one or two people, but with a lot of people.
Yes, and it is really different because you mightn't think it, but I'm really odd. And I'm not a great mixer, contrary to what people would think. And I just like to be there in the box room working away quietly on the poems or reading other people's work, you know, getting familiar with who's writing what in Ireland and the world. So the screenwriting is different because you'd have input here and there, and then you'd get an email, and then you get a voice message, and it's kind of very different. It exposes you to having to communicate with other people, you know.
Are you at the stage where, as I'm reliably told, the phrase is that you're having meetings with important people?
We did have one very important meeting, and as Tom Kelly said to me the other evening, if it's in the City Tribune, it must be true. And it was in the City Tribune, so it must be true.
Are we allowed to ask what it's about, or is that all still under wraps?
Oh no, I can't. I can't say anything really. Just right. That it's not present day.
Oh, you're at the level of non-disclosure agreements now as well.
Yes.
Okay, fair enough. Look, let's go back to the poetry. You've an upcoming collection, is that right? Jiving with Wasps.
Jiving
coming
with
out
Wasps.
In next year. What can you tell us about that?
I can tell you that that's with Bloodex, and the poems I read tonight were from The Long Weekend. That was Gil. And I also work with Salmon from time to time, and indeed started with Salmon. So Salmon and Bloodex really are the publishers that kept me sailing all through the years. The new book is Jiving with Wasps, new and selected. I had kind of promised collected, but then I chickened out because I just have too many poems kind of, and we collected is too big. So I Neil Astley from Bloodex came to my house last year, and we had meetings and discussions, and we went through the poems, and I took out an awful lot, and he put in ones I took out, and he took out ones, and then I put them in. So it was like that. So hopefully it'll be okay.
Can you tell us a little bit about the new work that there is involved in the collection?
Well, the new work, what can you say about your new work? It just goes on, you know, maybe what's happening in your life or maybe not. I have a short poem. I have two very short poems from it.
I'd love to hear that. Yes, please.
Okay. So the word stow in this poem means a company, the Stow Story Labs from Stow, Vermont. Renville Swim. The Stow crowd go out to sea looking for scripts. They swim back, the scripts resting on their heads, the odd script, an albatross. And I'll give you one other short new one. Sorry about the paper. MRI. It's that pause when you are about to go into the tunnel and she is not in the mood for your whinging, and you ask if the headphones are on right, and she says, what difference does it make so long as you can hear? As you start to move in slowly and vertigo doesn't cut it, you say, oh no, in a very scary voice, and she says, right, so off you go, and you don't get to feel any more fear that day. And you are never, ever going back.
It would seem strange at this moment if I didn't mention that your namesake, Uachtaráin na hÉireann, President Higgins, is returning to Ruthún in a few weeks following his two terms as president. What are your thoughts on him, both, I suppose, as a poet and then as a patron of the arts? And I suppose, if we get to the end of it, as a Galway native?
Well, he's not actually a native. He wasn't born in Galway, but he is more than welcome to Galway. We love him. I'm delighted to hear that he is out of hospital this evening. And he was a scholar long before this. And he was the Minister for Arts, Culture and the Gaeltacht at one time. But he was always interested in the arts and culture. And I like him very much, I have to say, and I'm delighted that I'll have a chance to bump into him in the town hall or wherever in Galway.
But he is a blow-in, just to be sure, just to be serious. Okay.
Well, you know, facts. The truth matters. But he's very welcome. As I say, we love him.
I started off by mentioning the event at the Dublin Book Festival. I should probably get around to that. It can only be described as kind of a potent combination of wit and honesty between yourself and Áine Ní Ghlin, I've been reliably told, for the event at the Dublin Book Festival next week. What can people expect if they come along?
Well, Áine, I presume Áine might be reading some works, some poems from her new book, Dánta Idir Sean agus Nua. It's new and selected. And it was translated brilliantly by Theo Dorgan. I'm sure she'll be reading some from that. And we'll be facilitated by the amazing Éilis Ní Guaibhne, Laureate for Irish Fiction. So it's going to be very chill and it's going to be very honest.
You were talking about books that you're reading at the moment or collections that you're reading at the moment. Is there any that stand out for you that you want to recommend?
Well, I'm reading Arundhati Roy's memoir at the moment, actually, and her mother was fierce, and she never, I'm trying to think of the name of it, Mother Mary Come to Me is the name of it. Her mother was so critical of her. But she is so generous, and she loved her mother to the day she died. So it's a very fascinating book, and, you know, tons of poetry all over the place. And, you know, you just can't mention one poet without mentioning 25. So do you want to be here all night?
I also don't want to get you into trouble with the Irish poetry community. I genuinely don't. I don't think that's the way to go with this.
I know it.
Rita Ann Higgins, thanks so much for joining us tonight from Galway on Arena.
Míle fáilte, Rodrigh.
My thanks to Rita Ann Higgins for joining us this evening. She tells it straight, truth in Irish and English through bold and unsentimental poems, takes place at the National Library of Ireland next Thursday, November the 6th at 1 p.m. Attendance is free, but booking is required in advance at dublinbookfestival.com. And you're listening to Tuesday Night's Arena. The Dingle Distillery International Film Festival takes place over the weekend of the 7th to the 9th of November, with a lineup of films and events, including guest appearances by actor Aidan Gillen and director Alan Gilsonan. Irish writer, director and producer Ruan McGann will also be there. He will give a master's talk about his long career on the 8th of November, and two of his latest films will be shown, the documentary Our Blue World, A Water Odyssey, narrated by Liam Neeson, and the feature film Boccia, or The Drowned, starring Mo Dunford and Eleanor O'Brien. And I'm delighted that Ruan is with me now in studio. It would seem strange if before we had a conversation we didn't say anything other than to extend our condolences to you on the passing of Monacon from everybody here at Arena. It must be both a very strange time and yet at the same time maybe slightly heartening to see just how much love there was expressed from over the last few weeks.
Yeah, thanks for that, Rick. I mean, just we in the family have been so touched by the massive outpouring of love and the notes and all the messages that have come in to Monacon. And you know what? Nearly every single one of them has been about hope and joy and positivity and seeing a way forward. And it's just lovely to see something like that emerge from someone's passing. Of course, he's not gone, really. He's still with us. I think it all started on the radio for him with Arena. So Arena, he held a very, very, Arena held a very special place for him.
You did an awful lot of work together, which siblings that work in industries close to each other don't always necessarily do, but you did.
Yeah, you know, I feel odd now because I'm sitting in the very chair that he sat in about 5 weeks ago talking to Brendan. And in that, he talked an awful lot about what we did together. And it has been extraordinary. We didn't plan it. It just emerged that way. And we ended up going all over the world and making documentaries together. And Oscuelga, Vishishin on the Hochtach. And we're hugely proud of it. I think it's of all the work that certainly I did, it's some of the work I'm most proud of is what I did with him. And we just made it up as we went along. Initially, he couldn't present anything and I never directed anything. And Teaching Hour were very kind to us that they let us, you know, sort of figure it out as we went along. Anyway, great, great, great days.
It's your first time to screen films at the Dingle International Film Festival, but I mean, it's a part of the world that you know quite well.
Yeah, like Tasha Atamsa, Mar V. Gaelnagum, Nurvias Og, we spoke Irish at home when we were young. And there's a house that my great grandmother built down in Dingle, so we went to holidays there. We also went to school. I was in school on three occasions for three terms in Fionnach and Ballyteirig down there, and also for a few weeks in Moriach. So Dingle has a really, really important, plays a really important part in my life and also in my heart. So I'm so proud to be going down to Dingle with two films. I really can't believe that this is happening. I love it.
Let's talk about those two films then. There's the documentary Our Blue World and the feature film Boccia. Our Blue World seems very timely, particularly even just today with Hurricane Melissa bearing down on Jamaica at the moment. How did that film come about initially?
So it was the idea of a water scientist. His name is Paul O'Callaghan from Cork. And Paul is an expert on how to help companies get to zero water. So zero water means you're not making any impact on the water or on the environment. And also, ideally, you're not taking anything from the water system. You capture all the water from rain. So that's the kind of world he lives in. And one of the things that frustrated him was the fact that people maybe, we seem to have lost a connection with water, and which is very odd because we are nearly entirely made of water. This planet is a water planet. no life, nothing can exist without the water. If we look for life off this planet, we look for water on that planet. Water is everything, and yet, and our ancestors understood this implicitly. I mean, it's in our myths, it's in our stories. Every culture in the world has an origin story built around a flood. If you look at any, you know, baptism or you know, the washing of the hands in Islam, the Hindu river the Ganges for Hindus, water is absolutely an intrinsic part of everything. And yet somehow in this modern world, in our capitalist society where we expect everything literally on tap, we have sort of lost that connection. So the idea of the documentary is to maybe help people reclaim that feeling, but also be cognizant of the fact that we have changed. The world is now a modern world. So maybe to take some of that consciousness of the indigenous people, of our ancestors, and bring it into the modern world and see where that brings us.
Okay. Our Blue World explores our relationship with water and what can be done to help improve the climate crisis. It starts in Quebec on Lake Nemaska. We're going to hear now from Leanne Poa, ecological philosopher, talking about the Cree people.
The Cree have been here for a long time. Hundreds, thousands of years they've been living in this area. They are a culture of subsistence hunters, fishermen, trappers. And so in wintertime, they would go off with their family unit. Hello, you beauty. And you are nice and warm, huh? And they would go fish. They're following the water. This is the rhythm that was there maybe one or two generations ago. It's almost lost now.
Yeah.
There is this essential principle they live by, to take care of what takes care of you. And so if we take care of our waters, the waters will provide in plentitude for all of us, for all life.
And that's Leanne Poa, ecological philosopher, with her husky dog, talking about the Cree people on a frozen lake in Quebec. Tell us a little bit about how that came to be in the film and what it means to you.
Leanne is she's the spine of the film. She's an amazing person. She's dedicated her life to walking the rivers of the world to, I suppose, highlight the fact that we can no longer drink the water in the rivers. And she found out when she was up in Quebec, she went on one visit one year and she could drink the water. And 2 years later, she came back and she went to drink the water. And she said, don't drink that, it's poisoned. So in 2 years, it became poisoned by some lead mines. And so that made her realize, hold on a minute, this has been happening all over the world. It's just taking so long for the pollution to happen. We don't recognize it happening, but we've polluted the planet. And so she was walking the rivers now to just to remind us of that. The documentary Our Blue World is a really hopeful, positive film. I mean, the issue with climate is if we keep giving out to us ourselves and giving out to everyone, no one's going to want to listen. So this film looks at about 15 amazing people who in different ways are tackling the same thing, but they're making a hugely positive impact. And we left 100 other stories behind us that we couldn't fit in the film. So, and there are thousands more. So what we found making this film is that there are communities all over the world making positive change. Now, it's not to say that, you know, there's not a lot wrong. There's an awful lot wrong, right? It'd be naive to think not. But what is encouraging is that a lot of people are working to make a difference.
Do you think that's important? And I suppose it is, because there is a movement of people who are communicating within the sphere of, if you want to call it, climate change in general, but who feel that in order to make any effective change, the message has to be hope, the message has to be positivity, the message can't be there's nothing else left we can do about this. Mm. And that obviously films like yours are an important part of that.
Sure, yeah. I mean, like if you watch Our Blue World, there'll be no doubt in your mind that we haven't made a big mess of things, okay? But it just shows you how, you know, the power of an individual, the power of a local community can make a big difference. There's one gentleman called Kong Jian Yu who sadly passed away 3 or 4 weeks ago in a plane crash. But he's been leading a massive movement called Sponge City, which is lifting, literally tearing out the concrete from the middle of cities and turning those areas into parklands, which in the monsoon season can take the water and keep it. In our current system, we push it all out with channels and, you know, drains. So keep it there. And then when there's less water in the dry season, the water's still there and all the bugs and the critters and the birds and lovely life. And it's very, very nice feeling to live in a city that's full of water. He's done 200 cities across China already. And now he's dead, but he's built a movement of people, 250 people working in the Turin Association, and they are going to keep that going. So that's it. We can change things.
It helps when you're trying to deliver a message like this if you have a voice like Liam Neeson's gently guiding you along the way.
In a world.
And look, I wasn't going to go there, but here we are. How did you get involved with him? How did he become part of the project?
So Liam has been really, really kind to us over the years. He the first time I worked with him, well, actually the first time was on Michael Collins, which the amazing Neil Jordan's film. I was a location manager on that. But jumping way forward, he narrated a documentary we made called The Hunger, which is about the famine in Ireland. And he just has the most remarkable way of being able to parse and communicate what can be quite dry language in a history documentary or an environmental documentary and make it sound just wonderful. Like he's just mellifluous and can pull you in. He has a gift, which he's learned, which he talks from down here, you see, on the edge of his vocal cords. And if I do that, you'll get what he's doing. And yeah.
He's in the room.
Amazing to watch him. Amazing.
The water theme continues in the feature film, which is also showing at the festival. It starts with the body of a woman being found in a lake. Tell us a little bit about the film and about when and where it's set.
So Barcha is set in Connemara, an invented Connemara. We've gathered a couple of bits of parts of Connemara and brought them together with the magic of cinema to create a world that doesn't exist, but you can kind of want it to exist. There's a reservoir. There's a girl, Peggy, played by Eleanor O'Brien, and she's desperately in the 70s. We're in the 70s. She's trying to keep her bar together, but her siblings don't want. They want to sell it. And then this body turns up on the side of a lake and it's going to change everything. There's this whole sense in the story, which Sheena Lambert wrote, of things being submerged, secrets, things we don't know. But there's kind of a feeling that something's going to come out. Nearly all the characters have a secret. And it's kind of, I suppose, metaphorically, it feels like our own families or Ireland now, Ireland in the 70s, just those things we've hidden. And Eleanor's desperately, or Peggy's desperately trying to just keep her bar open. But as the film goes on, it looks harder. It looks like she's going to fail. I can't give any more away, but that's the story.
Best not to, I find. Well, tell us a little bit about setting it, when you set it as well. Fairly early on, there's a scene set in that very bar where a television is brought in and it's a colour television.
It's all Ireland Day. Yeah. It's a big day. And she's bringing a colour television into the bar, which there's great excitement about. Up to then, every television in the region's been black and white. But what we loved about that scene is it's one of those big, heavy televisions that you can carry on your own and not one of these massive flat screen things we'd have today. It's a film with no mobile phones in it, hardly any cars. It's a different time. And yet we went to a huge amount of effort with Conor Dennison, the designer, and Gemma Keenan, the costume designer, and Rona Fox, who shot it. We try to make the 70s feel very contemporary because Peggy's ambition is to make the present better, to make a really good future for Ireland. She's driven, she's very hopeful, and you've got then these undercurrents that are going to maybe undermine her quest.
We have a moment from the film here. We do meet Peggy Casey, played by Eleanor O'Brien, who's running the family pub at the heart of village life, and a few of the locals as well. Then Mo Dunford, as Detective Frank Ryan, arrives in the village. He's a stylish stranger who immediately puts his foot in it with Peggy. This is their first encounter.
How are you? I'm waiting, Clara, to fire on tea.
Ni eid fo. Ach, deid fo lawr tle ben, am ti?
Well, I say gard o'r dawd at hawl. Dirt in a egan lom gyr eif si an sio.
Oh, that's yn bloch dyr yna. Yr hig beg rhaid gwaeg e Jackins bloch lia.
Tam cynt yn agwyl an sioch mi hwysgynt o bloch dyr.
Ara, eich Peggy. Ni o'r lle gydyn of a job. Snachol sy'n llanish. A flach dwi a...
Frank.
So, Frank. Ond tos y thai gyrra ty'n ffis yw chon dŵn fawr her ffad.
Ni dŵn fawr hwyta am Carla. Gach shansk will gerdo daud hi segan loch. Tashbani made dit, canite.
That's Mo Dunford as Detective Frank Ryan arriving into Tea Casey, the local pub, asking to speak to the man of the house and ending up talking to the Ban on Tea, Eleanor O'Brien, as Peggy Casey. There's also the voice of Fionnuala Gygax there as Carla Casey, who's another one of the siblings and kind of reluctant barmaid as well. The visuals in this film are gorgeous. The lake is beautiful. It's almost John Hind picture, postcard, beautiful. But there's obviously more to all of that than meets the eye. In fact, possibly the more beautiful it is, the greater the possibility for what lurks beneath.
Thank you. that's about, you've summed it up perfectly. Yeah, no, it's, I mean, it, like, as there's a whole lot of stuff going on there in the way we designed it. We consciously went for a sort of a meeting of blues and greens. So if it's the green of the mountains, the blue of the lake and the sky, or if you look at nearly every costume that every character is wearing is a juxtaposition of blue and green. All the rooms are blue and green. We painted the bar blue. It's literally a rhapsody in blue and green. And so we did that because it's just this the feminine touch that Peggy is trying to pull Ireland out of the 70s. She's literally on her own, just trying to make something that is gorgeous, not grey and dark as the way we tend to depict the 70s. She's going, nah, it's something else. Like it can be the future can be wonderful, right? And then that creates a really nice tension between all the other characters who are with all these secrets. Yeah.
Does it allow you to be slightly more painterly with your visuals? Because presumably a film that's set in 2025, we know what that looks. We know that it has to look and feel like today, whereas you can take a certain amount of stylistic liberties if you're setting it in the 1970s.
I think that, yeah, that might be true. Is it also the case, though, that one can create the tone of any story and narrative by how you start colouring it and what sort of shading is and how you film it? So, you know, I've always been a huge fan of grading. So grading is once you've finished the film, the whole thing's done. You then bring the movie into a final studio where they have a massive amount, particularly now in the digital age, of control over the colour temperatures and the hues of things. You can literally turn a red to pink, or you can even turn a red to green if you have a lot of money in your Hollywood. But you can manipulate the feeling of the film by doing that. And I've had some conversation with my son. He says that people just go to watch this film. They watch it for lots of reasons, but one of the big reasons is going to be the grade.
You're giving a master's talk as Dingle this year as well. And you've made a lot of films at this stage of your career. So what's going to be the focus of that talk if people go along?
Well, I really excited to be giving a masterclass at the Dingle Film Festival. I think they have a really interesting lineup of other masters as well, or other people who are going to come and give these talks. So among some, it's wonderful to be among those people. The focus I'm going to kind of explore why it is or how it is I came to make to be an Irish language filmmaker when I was initially, or and still am in a way, very, very interested in mainstream cinema. So when I was young, I watched an awful lot. I was passionate about watching films. Like literally every afternoon, if I could possibly not be in school, I would be watching movies. So, you know, Brief Encounter, huge fan of it. Shane, love Shane, right? Jaws, like all these movies. And then I started working in the film business about 19 or 20, and I worked on Ron Howard's Far and Away. I worked with Neil Jordan on Michael Collins. I worked with Alan J. Capula on The Devil's Own. So that's where I thought I was going. But now, at this point in my life, I'm looking back going, oh, I'm actually primarily an Irish language director. I mean, I make a lot of international work, and it reaches audiences of many, many millions. But the things I'm supremely proud of are the work in Irish. And I want to do more of it. So that's it. So I'm just, the talk's going to just explore how that came about and how that happened.
Do you think that's less and less of a problem these days to reaching an international audience because now so many people are so comfortable watching, be it cinema or be it television, in a language that is not their own, including subtitles?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. I mean, so when I was a kid, we as I said earlier, we spoke Irish at home and we spoke Irish around Dublin, and we were mortified because no one else was speaking Irish. And as soon as I could, when I got to about 14, I stopped speaking Irish completely. So I'm a girl on a bocach. Like, it's like Tigame, Agus Fadlam, it sounds to you like I'm speaking it, but any fluent Irish speaker's gone now, he doesn't quite have it, right? But Tagwe on the gum, right? And so the funny thing is to go from a place where the language was so maligned and so marginalized and nearly dying, to now a place where we can make movies in it, and people, as you say, in America or Japan or France will quite happily consider distributing the film if it's a good film. They don't mind it's in language, is in the Irish language. That's a wonderful thing.
Yeah. It's been a joy talking to you this evening. Thank you so much for coming in, and best of luck with the events at the festival. The Dingle Distillery International Film Festival takes place over the weekend of the 7th to the 9th of November. And if you'd like to see either of Ruan McGann's films or go to the masterclass, you can find details at dinglefilmfest.com. When a member of the psychiatry team at the Royal College of Surgeons went along to see a play called The Examination by theatre group Broken Talkers, he had an idea of a collaboration that was hoped would explain psychosis to a wider audience and help in the healing of those living with it. Finally, the play is here. Joining me now is Gary Keegan, who's the co-director of The Mirror Stage and the company Broken Talkers, and Mary Cannon, Professor of Psychiatric Epidemiology and Youth Mental Health at the Department of Psychiatry at the RCSI. And you're both very welcome to Arena this evening. Thanks for joining us. Gary, this is a fascinating play. I'm going to come to you about it in a minute, but Mary, I want to talk to you first about how this collaboration came about in the beginning.
Well, a member of our, as you mentioned, a member of our team, Helen Coughlin, she had gone along to see The Examination, which is a play that Broken Talkers created to do with a prisoner and just different aspects of the prison system, and looking at it from the point of view of the prisoner, and a very powerful performance by Willa Walter. And as part of that, he actually experiences a psychosis in the prison, and it was just so powerful. And Helen came back and said, "There's this amazing company, and I think they can do something really exciting with psychosis." So we had got funding from the Health Research Board which funds what we call, it's called SciStar. It's this program to fund 5 PhD students to study different aspects of psychosis. And this was funded by the Health Research Board. And the PI, as we call it, the principal investigator, is David Cotter. He's also a professor in RCSI, in the Department of Psychiatry. I'm one of the co-leads, and so is Agnes Higgins. But the innovative part of this PhD programme was that each of the PhD students will work with somebody with lived experience of psychosis. So we have this panel of 5 people with lived experience of psychosis who are an integral part of this programme, this PhD programme. And there we have a lead, Mike Watts, who's the what we call PPI lead, it's our lived experience lead. So the Health Research Board also gives additional little grants to do public engagement work to try and bring research to the public. And it was David's idea, actually, David Cotter, to say, why don't we do something on psychosis in the theatre? So we got this additional funding from HOB, Health Research Board, and then we contacted Broken Talkers and they said, yes, we'll do it. So it's been a few years, but, you know, it's been a really exciting process. And now we're so excited to be here on the cusp of actually having the play going out in public.
Gary, before I talk to you about the Mirror Stage, maybe just very briefly remind people about The Examination, because the context of that and why it comes in some way to create this is an interesting one.
Yeah, it's an interesting parallel, actually, because the invitation to produce The Examination came from UCD, School of History, as part of another research project around health and human rights within the prison system. So again, there was a large academic research piece being produced by the university. And as part of that, again, a grant for a public-facing project, an arts project. And because the person at UCD had seen one of our previous shows.
Is there a pattern developing here?
I think it is. I think there might be. Look, we'll take it. I mean, it's all good. So again, there's a little bit of a parallel there as to how we're talking about this show this evening. But the examination itself, I think the real the real piece of luck there was encountering Willa White, and having the opportunity to work with him so closely, and to, because he's such a natural performer and such a charming performer, and coupled with the fact that his own lived experience of incarceration and his challenges, because he speaks about them so openly, it was a perfect combination, really. And I suppose it's chiefly the reason that we're all sitting around this table this evening.
What did you think when you initially got the first contact in this instance? Did you think we may have been down a similar route before, or did you think this could be something interesting?
Yeah, I suppose the invitations or the approaches come from time to time, and you have to take them at face value, and you have to meet the people who are making the invitation and see what their agenda is and look at practicalities around timelines and budgets, etc. But you also need to look closely at the subject matter. Is it something that you want to spend, you know, the next couple of years engaging with? Does it chime with what Broken Talkers are about? And in this case, certainly, because, you know, the feedback we were getting from attending the conferences, from meeting the people with lived experiences, that the stories weren't widely known and widely told. And I think the work that Phelim and I like to tackle is finding ways of telling stories that aren't often told, and to present them in front of audiences in an artful way, to really, I suppose, you know, to create a discourse, to, you know, as the examination did, to sort of change minds and really kind of create a condition within that sort of special theatre space, you know.
Mary, talk to us a little bit about psychosis and what it is exactly and why it's so important that we destigmatise it.
Well, psychosis is basically a condition where you lose contact with reality. So your brain confuses what's happening inside with what's happening outside, with the external world. And it's manifest often through hearing voices, through seeing visions, through having paranoid thoughts or thoughts that something unusual is going on around. And one of the, in the play, it's very nicely experienced. It's almost like, you know, when you're dreaming or when you have a nightmare, but you can't actually wake up. You're stuck in this, and it's something that I think it's probably the least understood of the mental illnesses by the public now. There's been a big drive to educate people, to increase awareness about conditions like depression, like anxiety, like eating disorders, like autism, and that hasn't happened with psychosis. So we felt this was an ideal opportunity to reach out to the public and say, we need to understand this condition. A lot of people do suffer from this. The only way to destigmatize a condition is to increase understanding.
So, Gary, when it comes to then creating a play, to creating a piece of art for which the starting point is this, where do you go? Where's your starting point then as a creator?
It's always the same, really. It's always about listening to the individual stories. That's really where it begins. So, you know, fundamentally, we're engaged in the task of telling stories. So, these stories were, you know, we met with a group of people individually over a number of months. We listened to their stories. We interviewed them in a studio. We recorded these interviews, and we stayed engaged with them to try to understand how best to portray their experiences. So really the starting point is what's the story?
Yeah. Tell me about the form the play takes then, because there are recorded voices of people with lived experience of psychosis. Then there are four dancers. Talk to me about that, the form of the play itself.
Yeah. So as our research was, you know, underway, like we had to certainly engage with the participants, you know, to listen to their stories. We also had to, I suppose, think about what form this piece would take, certainly. So for Phelim and me, it's always looking, each time we tackle a project, is like, what form does this theme require? You know what I mean? So it's, we're not going to assume that we know. We're not going to like do what we did the last time. We always look at the theme. We always look at the material that's in front of us, and we say, like, what form can best represent this. So an interesting thing happened quite accidentally in a number of the interviews. So one of the interviewees, when I asked them at the end of the interview, I asked them all to engage in this little creative exercise where I asked them to imagine what they would like to see on stage. And one of the participants, Nicola, quite clearly said, I see a dancer. I see a dancer on stage. And at that stage, we weren't thinking about dancers. But I asked, why a dancer? And she told me. And she told me that her early life experience was all around dancing. So she was able to tell me that, you know, that was an important image for her, that idea of a dancer. And she explains further in the interview. I said, well, how is she moving? Well, she's moving really quickly, like her mind is like her mind is going at 100 thoughts at the minute. And then Nicola describes in the interview quite organically how the music changes from a minor key to a major key toward the end, and the movement is calming down and the lights brighten up and stuff like that. So really she was talking about hope and recovery. And there were another couple of occasions when people that we interviewed came up with really finely minted comments, almost as if they'd been handed a script about mental illness and psychosis being embodied experiences, not just thoughts in the head. So it's almost as if we were being kind of nudged towards working with dancers, which we have done in the past and we always enjoy. But we took those prompts and we decided then that we would work with dancers in order to, yeah, I suppose, physically express these stories.
Mary, in the play, Jonathan says, I have a mind. It's useful, but it's not me. This mind is something amazing when it's used right. It's terrible when it gets mentally ill. It's complete torture. Mm. Is that something you recognise?
Yeah, that's a really powerful statement. Really powerful. And it's true that there is probably nothing more frightening than feeling you're losing control of your own mind. There probably is nothing worse. And that's what people have to struggle with. And yet they can't express this. And I think there's also a piece in the play where saying, you know, the family keeps saying, you need help, you need help, you need help. And the person themselves. But because sometimes when you're in this world of psychosis, you don't realise you're ill. You don't realise there is an alternative reality, and you lose, I mean, in psychiatric terms, we say you lose insight. But that's a way of being like, you're stuck. And it's so you know, I just felt like Gary was saying, there's so many phrases here that are so powerful. And it's you know, for me as a psychiatrist to hear that point of view is really helpful. Yeah.
Gary, when it comes to people coming to see the play, what kind of emotional response or maybe intellectual response or both do you want to see people take when they come away from the play?
Yeah, I just come from the rehearsal. Actually, we just moved into the theatre today, and we're starting to look at everything with the set and the lighting and everything, and the music and the whole lot. I think for me for me one of the things that's kind of to the forefront of my mind at the moment is really I hope that, you know, people would walk away with a better understanding of what psychosis is. And equally importantly, what it isn't, you know. We talk about, but the people that we've interviewed talk so eloquently about their experience of stigma, how they were treated. And I think that I hope that the piece that we've made kind of addresses where these kind of preconceptions come from, you know, through movies or through kind of maybe a sort of collective fear that we have of maybe that it could happen to us. And I suppose a little bit, you know, in this jurisdiction about the history of institutionalization and all of that kind of thing, that we, you know, I think if we bring it out into the open, if we talk about it, if we shed light on it, that maybe the fear is somehow dissipated. And you really do get to experience these wonderful people as they are, you know, I mean, through their voices, that they're very articulate and they have such a rich insight.
Thanks so much for joining us tonight on Arena to both Gary Keegan, co-director of the Mirror Stage and the company Broken Talkers, and Mary Cannon as well, professor of psychiatric epidemiology and youth mental health in the Department of Psychiatry at the RCSI. The Mirror Stage by Broken Talkers will be at the Project Arts Centre in Dublin from the 7th to the 12th of November. Projects projectartscentre.ie rather is the website for more details. Then it moves to the Everyman in Cork on the 18th and everymancork.com there for more details and booking. And that is Tuesday night's Arena. Reg Luby produced. Paula Shields was our researcher. Broadcast coordinator was Ollie Hamilton. And it was James Feeney on sound tonight. I'm Rick O'Shea. I'll talk to you tomorrow night from 7 here on RTE Radio 1, where amongst others we're going to be talking to Yorgos Lanthimos and Emma Stone and Jesse Plemons about the new film Begonia. John Creedon is next. After news, see you tomorrow.